move the heat around, and in addition, they pump a lot more moisture into the atmosphere through evaporation, which produces evaporative cooling of the oceans, and then that moisture in the atmosphere fuels storms, and a lot of that gets moved into higher latitudes to the storms that are crossing the Pacific and coming into your area in northern parts of the west coast of the United States. And there's a storm that's just recently come into California, for instance.
Japan and other parts of Asia just struggled through an endless record heat this past summer. It was terrible. Do you think that is related to the North Pacific Marine heat wave?
It probably is in some way. I mean, the patterns like that are set up in the atmosphere, and so there are some regions that are more what we call anticyclonic, more settled weather, less likely for storms to occur there, and other regions are much more active, and they tend to move around from one year to the next as the ocean interacts with the atmosphere, but the patterns have been quite distinctive, haven't they, in this past summer. And it's sort of been interesting also to watch the Atlantic, where it was predicted to be a very vigorous hurricane season, and there have been a number of hurricanes, but none of them have made landfall, really, in the U.S. And so there's a distinctive pattern there, and I understand that the air is generally subsiding more, which means anticyclonic conditions, and it's less favorable for the hurricanes to form.
That is fascinating stuff. You know, we hear a lot about Arctic sea ice and melting Greenland. Meanwhile, all the extra Earth energy also arrives unseen around the South Pole. We've been covering that on Radio EcoShock, and there's changing deep currents and melting glaciers. Should we be just as concerned about ocean heating around Antarctica?
Well, the biggest warming is actually in the Southern Hemisphere. The sea temperatures have certainly been at highest levels in the North Pacific and in the North Atlantic, but the penetration of heat because of the stronger winds is greater into the Southern Hemisphere. And there's a tremendous capacity for storing the heat there, and it gradually moves things around and begins to influence Antarctic sea ice, for instance. And some of that sea ice helps to act as a buffer for the glaciers that are flowing off of Antarctica, and so it begins to affect the flow of ice and icebergs. And, you know, watching these things in action occurring on a relatively slow timetable, no doubt, but they're certainly happening.
You have a new article published October 10th in the New Zealand publication Newsroom. With your years of working on international projects like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, why do you say net zero is a pipe dream?
The headline on that article was not chosen by me. It was one of the things I mentioned in the article. But the article was intended to be somewhat provocative and was oriented towards not only climate change and the fact that the climate is changing, but also all of the other environmental factors that are in play, and in particular, the growing populations, the increasing number of refugees, if you want to call them that. There's a lot of conflicts in various parts of the globe, especially in the tropics, you know, led by what's been happening in Gaza and the Middle East, but also in the Ukraine. But, you know, there are many other places as well in Syria and in other parts of Africa that are really problematic, and people are trying to get out of there, taking unsafe boats across pieces of the ocean in order to get to other places. And now there has been a major pushback in many countries against immigration. This is happening now in the U.S., and the Trump administration, in fact, has a very active program of seeking out non-legal immigrants and exporting them, in fact. But it's happened also, there's been quite large changes in places like Germany and France, and even in the UK. This pushback is creating extra problems, and that's part of what I was addressing in this article, that with climate change, there are environmental refugees that happen because of droughts and crops not growing and fish no longer being available where they used to be. And so these kind of pressures mean that there's a real conflict that seems to be growing around the world, with too many people not happy where they are and not being able to go somewhere else. And that's a key part of what my article was about.
You also talk about coming water shortages, and that is right now in Iran. They may have to move the capital out of Tehran as it runs dry. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with former NASA scientist James Famiglietti. Their new paper shows humans and climate change are sort of teaming up to drain global groundwater, and that is going into the sea. They found groundwater transfer is currently a larger source of sea level rise than either Antarctica or Greenland melt. That surprised me. Does it surprise you?
Yeah, I don't believe that, actually. I mean, the groundwater ultimately comes from rainwater, at least in the sense that it gets renewed, and there are have been major depletions of the groundwater in that area, and also in India in particular, where they've been tapping into the groundwater and using it for irrigation and various other purposes in non-sustainable ways. But global sea level is going up at around, 5 millimeters per year, and that's a huge amount of water. A relatively small region, I did a study in 2011 when there were major rains in a La Nina event over Australia, but even that was able to take out about 2 or 3 millimeters on a global basis out of the global oceans. And so that's sort of the magnitude, but that's a much larger area than is currently being talked about.
And the subhead for your new article said crops now grown will no longer survive. And that's a big statement. So I did a bunch of digging, and sure enough, there are at least a dozen articles in the last 6 months, scientific, peer-reviewed, about climate limits to crops that feed billions of people. What do you think about crops when we go over 2 degrees C of global warming and beyond?
Yes, so this is indeed the issue. There's a lot of rhetoric about, increasing carbon dioxide helps plants grow. But that's only true if the other environmental conditions are okay. And if there's increasing drought, as there tends to be, the dry spells are more widespread and longer lasting. That, in turn, increases the risk of wildfire. And these are things that we see happening in the United States and in other places, in Canada and other places around the world. And so there's a real threat to the ability to grow plants in various places. And the key question is, if there's a wildfire and all of the forest or some other regime of planting is wiped out, can the crops grow back? And the evidence begins to suggest that by the time you get to the mid-2050s, when carbon dioxide has doubled in the atmosphere, then maybe there's many places around the world where things won't grow back. And, if the patterns that are occurring now, subtropical deserts, can maybe spread even a little bit further towards to higher latitudes, towards the poles where many people are currently living. And some people say, everything will just shift a little bit further to the north. But that assumes that the dirt, the quality of the soil is suitable for those plants to grow there. And that's a very dicey assumption, and in many cases it's not borne out. A lot of the ground is not suitable for agriculture, especially in hilly areas. It may be suitable perhaps for growing grass and having cows and cattle work on it, or something like that, or sheep, but it does indicate that there will be changes that are sort of forced upon farmers of various kinds, and that tendency is likely to increase over time.
Yes, I can tell you as a Canadian that the bogs and the Canadian Shield, the bare rock that's in the north, is not going to grow the wheat that was growing further south, but now it's too hot. We were talking about how the water warms up unevenly, and your April 2025 paper finds it clustering around 40 degrees north, that's sort of America, the Mediterranean, North China Sea, and 40 degrees south, which is around Tasmania and your own New Zealand. Does abnormal ocean heat translate into more extreme weather on land and people in those mid-latitude belts, do we know?
Yes, so the warmer water means that when the appropriate storms come along, there is increased evaporation into the atmosphere, and in fact, we can actually measure that. And often it's what we call these atmospheric rivers. There are flows of high levels of moisture that then penetrate into places like New Zealand and recently in Tasmania and into other places in the Northern Hemisphere, for instance, that can result in flooding, which is quite substantial. So the increased moisture gets recycled through the atmosphere and has consequences.
Do you pay much attention to what's happening with the coral?
Somewhat. I mean, there are stories that the corals are in serious trouble because of, especially the Great Barrier Reef and the areas there, because of the rising temperatures in the oceans. And I think that's certainly partly true, and it's certainly true with certain species of corals. What I'm not sure about is that there seem to be quite a number of different varieties of corals that exist, and whether other corals might eventually, take their place. And I'm not sure that there's enough knowledge about those aspects of things, or whether the aquatic systems can respond in that way or not.
Well, it's interesting to note the original coral reef builders went extinct around 250 million years ago, and then after a few more millions of years, today's tropical coral moved in, but they're a completely different species. So I guess there's always hope for coral, but the 2025 Tipping Point report finds that as far as the tropical big corals of the Pacific are concerned, they've already crossed the line of no return. I'm pretty concerned about that.
Yes, so this relates to the process that we're really talking about is adaptation, whether the system can adapt and evolve fast enough to keep up with climate change, and that's really the issue. The climate change is occurring so rapidly that there's really worries, and there should be major worries that this is not the case.
So adding this all up, do you see a civilizational threat on the horizon?
Well, that's what my article was intended to be provocative about. I mean, I didn't mention AI. I thought I could have. I did think about it, but I thought, oh, that's just a bit too much for this particular article, because they always tend to have word limits on articles like this. And so I didn't actually pull that in there. But, there's enough going on, and I think far too much of what's going on is simply not sustainable. The way in which we're using so-called natural resources of various kinds, including even the developments in agriculture that have been so productive and very good, and the developments in cattle and animal use in developing meat and other food that is for humans and so on, there has been really impressive developments there. But ultimately, they're probably limited. And this is one of the worries that I have, is that there are just too many people in too many places, and they create pressures, and they create, ultimately, local conflicts, and some of those conflicts grow into be bigger conflicts, and then you can have some people in authority who are not addressing those issues and, in fact, seem to take advantage of them. And I really worry about this. So in China and India and in the U.S. now, there are tendencies for strong authoritarian governments and not really planning to address these kind of issues.
I might make a small exception for China, because China has been funding a lot of climate research and reports, and they are the world's largest installer of solar panels and things like that. So I think they have climate change on their roadmap, but...
I agree with you. They've done some incredible things, but I've had quite a bit of experience and interactions with the Chinese through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and my strong impression is that the Chinese always do what they do for their own benefit. And if their own benefit happens to benefit, you know, the rest of the world, that's more or less a coincidence, not really a core part of their planning. It's not the kind of leadership that used to exist in the United States, I don't think. But and I think India is in much the same way. India does what they can for their own population and for their own benefits, and if it happens to benefit anyone else, it's a coincidence.
Well, that describes most of the countries that I know. Unfortunately, it seems to be a human problem that we can't develop a global consciousness.
Yes, and so this also relates to the ineffectiveness of the United Nations, which is more debate chamber, but doesn't seem to be able to put things in place or carry out actions that really make advances.
From Auckland, New Zealand, we've been speaking with well-known scientist Kevin Trenberth. I use Kevin's book, The Changing Flow of Energy Through the Climate System, as my lookup for many Earth systems. You can find links to all the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you for spending more time with our listeners.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
As you heard in that interview with Kevin Trenberth, ice sheets versus groundwater loss and sea level rise is still debated. According to a new study published July 24th in Science Advances, groundwater loss is raising sea levels more than any ice melt at either pole. In my September 10th show, I spoke with study co-author and longtime NASA scientist Jay Famiglietti about that paper. In this week's interview, Kevin Trenberth, as an initial reaction, doubts that transfer of groundwater to the oceans contributes more to sea level rise than either Greenland or Antarctica. Trenberth says global sea level is going up around 5 millimeters per year. Estimates about that vary a bit, and some years do rise more than others. Trenberth raises his own 2011 study, which is sobering. A big rainfall event over Australia dropped so much water, it led to a rare drop in global sea levels, temporarily, despite long-term rising seas. Thousands of people fled flooding communities in Australia. Their Bureau of Meteorology reported that the second half of 2010 was the rainiest since record-keeping began in 1900. The Christmas 2010 rains flooded an area the size of Germany and France combined. 40 Queensland coal mines closed. Wheat to sugarcane crops were ruined. It was epic. Those who lived it never forgot. Combined with heavy snows in North America and rains in South America at the same time, Trenberth said this unique event in recorded history lowered sea level by about 5 millimeters. They called it a sea level bump. Water was removed from the ocean and dumped on the land that year. Nevertheless, satellite measurements say the 20-year trend is land losing water to the sea. We know more energy in the troposphere due to greenhouse gases and warmer oceans leads to more evaporation and a higher capacity of the atmosphere to hold moisture. It won't all stay up there, of course. The key is, where does the resulting rainfall come down? A simplistic answer would be, well, because ocean covers far more of Earth's surface, more rain will fall there. And unlike land, there is nowhere for it to run off. However, Earth's systems are so complex. For example, mountains may trigger rainfall, air currents may steer heavy rainstorms towards certain regions, and we know some human emissions, even plant emissions, lead to particulates in the air, the aerosols, that can stimulate rain formation. Another complication, more rain is reaching and falling on the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. That adds to their load and their sea level contributions, but only later, after a time delay. Even so, the Chandrapurkar and Famigliati et al. Study is not based on models or conjecture. As far back as 2014, Famigliati and NASA's GRACE satellites published measurements of California losing mass. The rocks don't change, so only missing water could explain that loss of gravity. The debate would be, how much water has been transferred to the ocean, and can that water be returned by superstorms or atmospheric rivers and extreme rainfall events over land, as Trenberg studied in Australia? Also, a current boom in water transfer from land to oceans may just be temporary as we pump it up. The trend may increase or decrease depending on human actions, like whether we continue to pump out groundwater on such a scale, and whether we continue to add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. It is possible Greenland ice melt or Antarctic ice melt will increase beyond this land-sea transfer to become dominant. Given past ice history and the amounts of water stored in those glaciers, that seems very likely. We are not going to get 25 meters or 82 feet of sea level rise from groundwater running or falling into the sea. That requires the ice realms to release water collected over millions of years.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
A headline cut from Kevin Trenberg's new article says, crops now grown will no longer survive. Kevin tells us he meant to be provocative. Hardly anyone is talking about this threat as we add billions more people to the planet with shrinking resources and accelerating climate change. According to a paper March 2025 led by Finnish researcher Sarah Hoikkanen, quote, potato, maize, which is corn, wheat, and soybean. These staple crops account for much of the global food supply. At 3 degrees C, large parts of their production, especially in low-latitude regions, could fail or face drastic yield reduction, though impacts are more moderate in higher latitudes. Rice, particularly threatened, with as much as 17% of production already outside suitable zones at 2 degrees C of warming. Impacts become more severe at 3 degrees C, especially in low-latitude Asia, end quote from Sarah Hoikkanen. And she and her colleagues include, under a 3 degrees C warmer world, many staple and specialty crops currently grown, especially in tropical and equatorial zones, will likely become unviable on a large scale, with particular risks to coconut, yam, cowpea, pigeon pea, rice, maize, wheat, and soybeans. Mid to high latitude regions may see less severe impacts, but widespread crop adaptation or migration will be necessary to avoid catastrophic food supply losses, end quote. And you can find a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Add in climate-induced or aggravated droughts, some lasting years, plus extreme rains as hit Australia, and generally destabilized weather, well, crops will fail in places, likely leading to mass migration by anyone able to leave, as Kevin suggests. Check out my April 2023 show, Nomad Century. That's with UK author and broadcaster Gaia Vince. You can find that at ecoshock.org. That's the real sauce on climate, crops, and mass migration.
Radio EcoShock.
As we check out, a worried hello to many listeners in California. Everybody knows insurance is going nuts there, especially after years of wildfires and other disasters. Allstate stopped writing new homeowner, condo, and commercial insurance policies in California since November 2022. Other companies left the state or stopped writing any property insurance there. Those who can't get insurance can apply to a government-run program called FAIR. According to blogger in the know Susan Crawford, California's FAIR plan seeks 36% rate increase as wildfire risk and insurer exits surge. With $650 billion in exposure, but just $1.5 billion cash on hand, the math no longer works. Homeowners face costly coverage, rising assessments, and a volatile market going forward, ending a quote from Susan Crawford. Now, with layoffs and rising prices, more California properties may have to go without insurance, you would think, except then the banks won't provide a mortgage. What will it be this week, kids? Food or a home? When human failure meets implacable climate change, the math of life no longer works. We are at a hinge point. Massive social and economic change might lead to survival, possibly with better, more meaningful lives. That's the hope. As Bishop Tutu said, I am not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening. Tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.